This is Art Musings with Love from Oxford, a podcast where we natter with local artists, learn about their process, their work, and delve deep into creative, emotional, and business challenges. So basically the juicy bits, the dark underbelly of being an artist. I'm Carol Terrio, a painter focused on watercolor and inks.
And I'm Sally Ann Stewart, a lino cut printmaker who loves depicting the beautiful city we live in. We're kicking off our art careers and are hoping to learn a few tips and tricks from those around us. And we thought you might like to join us. Allons-y.
Allons-y. Now, before we kick this show off, I think, Sally, we have a little announcement to make, don't we?
We do. It's terribly exciting. Carol and I have both been accepted to the Oxford Art Society. We made it in.
Yay us. Yay us. Definitely. It's a big deal, isn't it? We've been working towards it for a few years. You have to enter many open exhibitions and then they judge your work and allow it in and then you can apply. So, yeah.
Been on tenterhooks. And then we finally got the word on Saturday.
Totally. And we're in good company. It's in its 132nd year, and it has luminaries such as Ruskin and Burne Jones, Gilbert Spencer, the Nashes, John Piper. So we're among them now, Sally.
I think we're pretty much on a par with them, you could say.
Well, hats off to everyone who applied, whether you got in or not this year, because it is super tough to pull together the application. So even to be bothered to do that is worth, you know, a bit of a high five. Should we crack the show on? Yeah.
So today on Art Musings, Carol and I are chatting with Emmett Casley. Now, Emmett is a painter, a printmaker, and a sculptor, and recently completed his master's degree in fine art at Oxford Brookes University. Emmett creates some incredibly bold and striking work, much of which focuses on place, on the forms and structures that make up our landscapes and environments, and our relationship with these. So we'll talk to him about that and about how his artistic practice has evolved, particularly following his master's.
And today's topic that Emmett has chosen is Wonga, or Dosh, Capital, Moolah, Bankroll, whatever you want to call it. We all need some of it to live. And the question is, how can artists make art pay enough so that we don't have to split our time and focus? Like, if I were going to put all the hours I practice and take courses to improve my skills, plus all the costs of tools, supplies, materials, plus the costs of entering competitions and markets. Like, Sally, you did that 3-day market recently. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah. So it was a 3-day craft fair in Abingdon. This fair has been going since the 1970s, I think. It's got a really loyal following. So I was really excited to take part, and it's in the beautiful old Abbey buildings. But I basically did not have a very good 3 days at the office. I was really excited about it. And I think before markets and fairs and things, I sort of get quite hyped up because you know it's going to be, you know, a good opportunity to be out there, hopefully making some money, you know, meeting lots of people.
And it's like an 8-hour day, right? When you're at the market.
Oh, yeah. Generally kind of full on all day standing, chatting. But, you know, I get a lot from that because, as we've said previously, you know, working on your own in the studio can be quite isolating. So I think over the 3 days, I took about £500. So after paying for my pitch, that's £320.
That's like your table. That's where you're selling stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm paying for my stall. So just over £100 a day, really. After, you know, all the costs of your materials, packaging, framing, and then, of course, all the hours you put in, all the effort, that's a little bit galling.
I just did the math for you.
Don't do the math.
I'm doing the math. So 320 divided by 24 hours, because you did 8 hours a day for 3 days, is £13 an hour. And that's not even counting in the stuff that you know, all the work, all the stuff you had. It's not enough.
No, I have had ones that have been a lot better. And of course, hopefully most of the people at that fair They did a lot better than that. I know other people were really super busy, and maybe it wasn't just that one wasn't the right fit for me for who knows what reasons. So, you know, I can be kind of zen about it, and it's still, you just never know who you're going to meet when you go out and do things and what other opportunities might come your way. But that was a bit sad, but you know, hopefully our guest today might be able to give us some thoughts and tips on how he manages to make money out of art.
Exactly. Well, why don't we bring him on? So let's welcome Emmett Casley to Art Musings. Fantastic to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Cool. Now, before we start talking, we just want to share your socials or your website with people so they can look at your work while you're discussing it.
The best place probably to look at what I'm up to is Instagram, which is you can find me on there under Emmett_Casley. Mirror what I post on there on Facebook. So that would be under Emmett Casley, artist and printmaker. And I do have a website, which is emmettcasley.com, which is in severe need of updating, which is a black mark against me from the start. So.
You're not alone.
Okay.
Mine's just been birthed, so I feel it's very up to date, but I'm sure that situation's not going to last long. Emmett, you are a man of many talents, both artistically and in your life outside art. And I think I should probably share with our listeners how we first met, which was you building our garden room, not mine and Carole's, mine and my husband's, back in 2020. And I must say, it's, you know, a garden office type thing. It's not like a garden room with a swimming pool in it or anything. Sadly, one day after we've had this chat and we know how to make money.
I'd be over way more often if he did.
Now, at that point, I was probably a year or so into taking lino cut quite seriously. And I honestly hate to think where I would have been now had I not met you at that point in my printmaking career, because it was honestly like an art angel had been sent from up above. Because up until that point, I was self-taught, you know, via YouTube and whatever. You know, meeting someone who could just say, you know, try these slightly more expensive tools because they'll make a big difference, or look at different rollers. And even you lent me your stuff. And just if I was struggling with a bit on a print, you know, you said, well, why don't you try this? And obviously it worked perfectly. So that all gave me a huge boost. And I know I've said it to you before, but thank you so much, because that really did help me massively.
It shows that power of just conversation and meeting other artists. And I think it's really easy in our field to look at what we're doing and look at people we consider to be sort of extremely adept and go, well, I don't have that level of knowledge, so I'm not going to have anything to share with someone or be able to benefit someone else. I work in lino, I work in very few other fields, and I keep it very simple. Your work is much more complex, but it's just that, you know, I had a little bit of more experience of some certain tools, and it was brilliant that helped you at that point.
Oh, it really did.
And I was looking at what you were doing, blown away by it. You know, you were making big leaps with every single print. You still, you know, you are. And you're not afraid of challenges. And it's a fantastic thing to see. And it just comes from those conversations.
Well, thank you for those very kind words. But it shows as well that you don't need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of things to teach someone. And that's partly what I've learned through doing some workshops as well, is that you know, I first thought with teaching, oh, I've got to know everything. People are going to ask me all these questions and I won't know the answers. But that's definitely not the case.
Yeah, just saying I don't know is pretty good. It works.
Yeah. I know, but a workshop the other day, someone came up with a much simpler solution to something than I had in my head. And I was like, oh, yeah, thank God you're here, because I was going about that all the wrong way. So that divulged. We would love to hear about how your art career got started. Were you arty as a child?
It was one of those things where at school, I always remember drawing as a child, not specifically sort of, you know, drawing what I was seeing, but, you know, just things that were in my head. And as a young boy, went through stages of being obsessed with drawing cars and all kinds of stuff like that. But it was always a kind of a safe space for me, I guess, in a lot of ways, with it. Just something you can lose yourself in, and it can be easy for us to forget that as adults. the sort of power of that. And I moved school quite a lot, but art departments of schools, again, were somewhere where I thought, I know where I am here. I know I've got an ability level. I think, like for a lot of kids at primary schools and secondary schools, again, the art block or the art studio at school became somewhere where I invariably, once I got comfortable, I was there in lunchtimes and break times, regardless if I had an art class that day. It was just, I knew where I was. That was like my territory.
So jealous of that, because at my school, we had no art department where I first went to school, like none. Not even in my secondary school, I think. Isn't that sad?
But also, like, we had one in mind, but it wasn't somewhere that you could just go at any time. Yeah, I wish I'd done that. I mean, maybe I could have just forced myself on them, but...
You know, without wanting to go massively off topic on this, I think we've got a glaring problem in our education system within our sort of primary and secondary schools, in that they're sustained through the enthusiasm and commitment of the people who run those departments, because they're dramatically underfunded. They're underprioritized within our education system. You know, we all know the value of the creative industries to this country economically and culturally, but they survive on the vocational commitment of the people who run them. And they survive because it's other artists generally who are working in these places, and they have to do it. And they truly believe in the value of it to those students.
Yeah.
They are still there, but it's largely because those people fight tooth and nail to keep them going. So, you know, it's an invaluable resource, you know.
Mm. So that's where you were, and that's where you felt at home whenever you were moving schools, and you could always find the art department and then find your feet and feel comfortable, like your little security blanket.
Yeah. And then I took myself, without really talking to my parents, I applied to art college and just announced I had an interview. And then we were living abroad at the time. So I was sort of 15 and got a flight back to Plymouth, flight back to the UK, and made my way down to Plymouth, went for my interview and thankfully got a place. And I did this instead of A-levels because I was determined I wasn't going to stay in school. Yeah, so I did a diploma there and then ended up doing an undergrad in design, which took me a long time to get my head around why I'd done that and whether it was the right fit or not. But that was pretty much my start, really.
So you come out of design school, and what do you do then?
Well, then I sort of came out early 90s, period of recession. I was just trying to find it. There was a massive amount of people, every job that you applied for. And I was in my head, I was like, right, I'm going to be a designer. This is what I'm trying to do. What I realized doing the course and what I ended up doing my dissertation on was actually, it was fine teaching people these skills, but I was leaving a very well-resourced workshop and studio facility to come out and find that I couldn't afford that equipment. I couldn't afford that studio space. And then looking at the funding options that were available. So I came out a little, not really sure where I was going to go, applying for every job that I could remotely sort of shoehorn or rewrite my CV or qualifications around. There were hundreds of people applying. You know, I had folders and folders filled, which then I had to, you know, I was trying to get benefits to, because I was unemployed, and you had to keep all of these stacks of applications, and it was quite demoralizing. I did eventually get a job. I was working for a company doing designing software front ends, you know, graphics, and that worked for a while. It, you know, got me where I needed to be, and I enjoyed it. But it was the start of a pattern which, in hindsight, where I realized it kind of ticked a box for me creativity-wise, but it wasn't really hitting the mark. I'd throw myself in, and then after a while, it wasn't hitting the mark, and I would get a bit despondent, and I'd be able to do the job, but, you know, my energy wasn't there. And it took me quite a while to realize that I needed to focus on it more, and maybe just accept that perhaps a job that wasn't art related but gave me enough time to be able to focus on what I wanted to do in art was maybe a better solution than trying to make everything that I did art and pay. And then there's, you know, and then I think you can get a bit of perspective or give yourself some breathing room and take some pressure off.
Yeah. When did that change happen for you?
One of those things, printmaking was something I'd done. And you'll know this only too well, Tully. When you do things like Art Weeks or if you do a fair, someone will say to you every day, oh, I did that at school.
Yeah.
and then you have a conversation about, you know, the little red handled plastic tools and blah, blah, blah. So that was pretty much my experience of it. And then it was in one of those things of trying to get into something that I could do at home that didn't require a studio space, that didn't require a massive investment in time, that I started just doing little lino cuts. And sometimes it was just because I wanted to do a carved design, or there'd been some photograph I'd taken I wanted to do a print of. And then I did a workshop day with the Whiteham Studio.
Yeah.
Was with Robin and Rosie. And that was a one-day course. And I have to say, there are some very good liner cut courses with a lot of different people. Sally.
Other workshops are available.
Other workshops are available. But what I would say is anyone who's done it or has fond memories of trying that in the past, go and do it, because it's a wonderful way to lose yourself for 3 or 4 hours or for a day. And I did this course, and it was in the old music library room of the Bodleian.
Oh, wow.
By these beautiful presses that Richard Lawrence keeps running. And it was a fantastic experience. And one of the first things they said at the start, there was about 12 of us there, and they just said, right, who can draw? And about half the class kind of tentatively put their hands up. And then a couple of people said, no, well, I definitely can't draw. And they said, don't worry about it. You'll get something good out of it. I've still got the poster upstairs. They did a print at the end of the day, which had everyone's print on it.
Wow.
Like a big poster with some lovely typesetting. You wouldn't be able to tell looking at those prints who had their hand up for drawing ability and who didn't. And it's one of the beautiful things about the medium. And it was, everyone walked away thinking, yeah, I could do this. And like I said, it's great because you can do it on the kitchen table with a roller and a couple of tools and a wooden spoon to burnish your print. And I love that immediacy. It was something I could do when my son was a baby. I could do it after everyone had gone to bed. I could do it, you know, in a spare hour, I could work on something and then put it away. And then eventually it just gets a bit out of hand and you realize you need a bit more room.
That's where I'm at right now. But yep, I hear you.
Now, you mentioned Richard Lawrence there, Emmett.
Yes.
When we had Alex Singleton on, he mentioned Richard as well. He does a lot of letterpress, doesn't he, I think? He's in East Oxford.
My apologies if I get this wrong, Richard. As I understand it, Richard looks after all of the letterpress presses and type at the Bodleian. So if you're, for instance, if you're in the Western Library building, they've got a press there just inside. I think Richard is the person who checks that that's running and demos that. He's often doing stuff up at Whiteham when they're open for things like Art Weeks, and they do workshops up there.
And that's Rosie's studio in the woods up there.
Yeah. That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, amazing place.
And they've got these roundel buildings as well where they run these little short courses on, I think they do pottery up there now, and they do printmaking. And Richard just, he knows these machines backwards. And the workshop that I did, Robin and Rosie were there helping and guiding everyone with what they were doing with their prints. And Richard is this incredibly knowledgeable, quiet man, and he just helps you get what you need to do. He's, you know, it's tangible when you meet him, the amount of knowledge that he's got, but he's just really helpful, and he just helps you do these amazing prints. And I was frustrated probably for about 18 months after them, because I just thought, like, I was able to get this amazing print immediately when Richard put it through the press, and then subsequently I could not get those depths of blacks and that kind of thing. But yes, such a helpful man and a huge amount of knowledge.
Great. Well, let's get back to you, Emmett.
Yeah, sorry, rambling. I did warn you about the ramble.
No, sorry, my fault. I led you off down that one. Printmaking's been a big part of your art career so far, but you have started to expand into a range of different media. What are you loving working with at the moment? Because I saw on your Instagram that you've been doing some stone carving recently.
I don't know, I'm guessing about 10 years ago, I suppose, that I'd started getting back into printmaking. And I enjoyed it for a good while. And then I realized I was just feeling like I was getting into a bit of a rut. And printmaking's a weird, well, it's not a weird world. It's wonderful. And there's so many people who are very dynamic, but it kind of splits in different ways. You've got people who do limited runs, and they're maybe not, they don't fit into that sort of traditional printmaker of, you know, produce an image, you do these editions of 30, 100 or whatever, and they're pristine, and they, you know, they have this regularity, they have these series worked out. And then you've got people who are maybe going down the sort of monoprint sort of route, but they're maybe working with lino and things are a little more random. And I kind of was bouncing between the two camps and getting frustrated, but also I just felt like I was in a bit of a rut with it. And after a while, I just thought, I don't know that I actually consider myself to be a printmaker. I love the medium.
Mm.
And for some people, it's a craft experience, if you like. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense at all. They fall in love with the process and they love that side of it. And it's about representing images that they've seen or views that they've seen. And it's very much, you know, in the finest tradition of printmaking. And then some people, it's a more expressive process. And I think I started realizing that as much as I love it, it wasn't the be-all and end-all of what I wanted to do. And through speaking to people, local artists like Mark Clay and Kate Hipkiss and Zelga Miller and Katie Taylor, the Oxford art scene, there's quite a few people who've been through Brooks or undergrad level or postgrad. And I just thought, maybe seeing what they'd got out of this course, maybe this was what I needed to do. Yeah, so I bit the bullet during the lockdown, so I put my application in. And I'm so glad I did, because I wanted something that was going to force me out of my comfort zone and push my practice.
Mm.
And it reawakened some things from way back. You know, going through art college as a 16-year-old, you know, working in that three dimensions, working with, you know, welding, ceramics, I'd missed a lot of this because I'd started working in construction, building studios. And
very well.
Thank you.
Other studio builders are available.
Yes. We don't need to talk about them. So I just realized that actually a lot of these things needed to be part of my process and were part of my process, and I just needed to confront it a little more head on. And also I think I'd got very nervous about the idea of whether my ideas and the line of inquiry I was following was strong enough, or whether I was able to develop that. And that was something that the masters really helped me. It helped me figure it out, but more than anything, it helped me gain confidence in myself and my thought process.
I was just going to ask you about man-made landscapes versus natural landscapes. How do you divide them, and do you have a preference?
I like looking at a landscape and seeing the evidence of our interaction, interference, or our impact. Sometimes I don't like what I see.
Mm.
I think it's very interesting, our perception in this country of our landscape and what we consider to be untouched. And
yes, I'm Canadian, so I think it's funny too.
I mean, if you read someone like Robert McFarlane, where he talks about truly wild spaces within the British Isles, there are very few. You know, I love going to Cumbria, for instance, and the Cumbrian landscape is not the natural landscape that it once was. You know, this is a massively altered landscape.
Mm.
Where I'm from down in Cornwall, and where a lot of my MA work came from, was really seeing and looking at a landscape in Penwith. We're talking about the area down the coastline that I was really focusing on, is, if you like, the coast that's right onto the Atlantic between Land's End and St. Ives.
Mm.
In the summer, it can be beautiful, very changeable, but it can be a very hostile environment. And this area was the centre of tin mining for Cornwall for a good period of time. And that industry shut down in the late 80s. And my grandfather used to work there and uncles worked there. It was a significant employer for the area. And these were, at times, pretty brutal, brutal places, landscapes, yeah, huge piles of crushed stone. And now that the industry has subsided and nature is taking it back, people talk about it as like, you know, these beautiful environments, and they are, but people realizing what was there and that it isn't always that pretty. And, you know, when people talk about going to move to somewhere like Cornwall and how wonderful it is, I'm like, yeah, see if you can do 4 weeks in March or February. And if you love it, then go to the estate agent, you know. But
God, 4 weeks in February is hard anywhere, let alone amongst abandoned tin mines.
Exactly. So, yeah, so it's that I'm interested in that way that our, you know, what our view of a landscape is when we go to somewhere and understanding that history, because I think the detachment that some communities have had through loss of those local industries, what really tied them to that land and maybe their family's history and their heritage, with that all being lost. And so Cornwall, so much of employment is based around tourism and hospitality. There is a natural detachment, and I think when you look at the broader spectrum of what our socio-political climate is in this country, that detachment feeds into things in many different ways. You know, we're a country that talks about our pride in our history and our, you know, industrial heritage, and yeah, it's fallen away from a lot of places, and that for me ties very directly into the history of those landscapes.
It's almost like we kind of whitewash the past, the hardships that people, the reason people were there, and you know how hard it was when it went away, and now it's just a pretty place to go for a holiday. It's an interesting way to think of it. I'm going to keep that in mind. Yeah.
Okay. And also, because if you live there, you spend a lot of time with people coming down for 2 weeks telling you how lucky you are to live there.
Totally.
You know, and you're living on minimum wage, probably, you know, running three jobs to pay the bills. So it's, you know, it might be beautiful, but it's not always an easy.
No, and it's a wild place as well, right? My parents-in-law live in Loo in Cornwall, and right now the entire main street is flooded completely, and all the houses along the main road because of the big rains we had, the gales a few weeks ago. And it's devastating. Yeah. And this is winter. There's no tourists there now, right? They're there all summer. You can't walk for tourists, but you know, when they need help, there's no one there. So. Maybe we should move on to our focus topic for today. What do you guys think?
Definitely.
Yes.
Our focus topic for today, making a living. Now, the term starving artist is a bit of a cliche, but the reality is it is incredibly hard to make a living as an artist. Emmett.
Yes.
How do you manage to house and feed your household, pay the bills, etc., etc., and make art?
Yeah, tell us, because we need to learn.
You know what you've said about the starving artist. I think we've all had to deal with people's different views of what our lives are like, and how we go about what we do. And the reality of it is I don't think there is one right way of doing it. And one of the keys to it for me, I think, is getting comfortable with how you've decided to do things and not beat yourself up about how you get to the goal that you have.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't suit everyone's practice for every hour of every day to be about your practice and that tying to paying the bills or monetizing what you do. Some people's work suits it perfectly, it's an intrinsic part of it. But that doesn't work for everyone. Or maybe you need to have periods where that can be the focus because it ties in with what your work is. But other times you need to give yourself a bit of room and just do your art and find a way that you can offset that time and do a job that helps you pay those bills but takes the pressure off. And I think that's where I've probably spent about the last 6 or 7 years trying to find that balance for myself with that. It's it's one of those things where I think I said earlier about having jobs that ticked a creative box in some way for me. And I think when you talk to artists, there's a lot of people who find their time doing that. They sort of think, well, I studied design or I study art, and and then I do this now. So that kind of ticks that, you know, it sates that need for me for something creative. But it's not always the same one. And I think it's almost worse in some ways to be doing something that's draining you in some way on that, but not really hitting the mark. But it's a full-time commitment, as opposed to maybe going, right, well, actually, I'm going to do this to pay the bills, and then I'm going to ring-fence that chunk of time to really focus on what I want to get out of my practice.
Yeah, I think you're making a lot of sense to me on this one, because I fear relying solely on art to pay bills for me, because it would take something that I find incredibly joyful, but also meditative. Like, I need to get into a certain headspace in order for my work to be good. And if I were worried, I would have a lot of trouble getting to that headspace, because I'd constantly have that jangly thing in my head going, is this going to sell? Should I make another cute cat instead of this difficult image that no one's going to really want to hang on their walls, that I really want to paint?
You're basically describing my life.
Oh. I'm sorry, Sals.
I like cute cats. You know, you're so right. And it's just kind of seeing what model works for you. But, you know, it's totally true that if you are relying on that solely to pay the bills, the pressure that I put on myself anyway to produce stuff that's sellable is pretty huge. And probably, you know, I wonder... I'm very self-critical, but I think, well, am I doing this wrong? Because am I not leaving myself then enough like leeway to experiment and just mess around and then develop more of a style, which is a conversation for another day. So I think whichever way you're doing it, you could probably find something to beat yourself up about.
When you take a step back and you look at what other people are doing, What can be dangerous is looking at it purely through the lens of, say, social media, for instance, because you're getting a very managed perspective on what people are doing then anyway.
Mm.
And again, this, you know, the power of getting out and talking to other artists and really seeing what's happening.
Yeah.
Going to things like art fairs, you quickly understand what the day-to-day grind is for people who hit every one of those art fairs and are putting those miles in. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, it's finding the right size bookcase that will fit in the car that you can display those prints on. That's as much of the distraction for the previous couple of days as it can be for actually making sure you've got all the right frames.
Can you carry said bookcase 450 feet because there's no car park nearby?
Yeah. I mean, all these things which are, but it's part of the game if that's what you're going to do. And I think I realized at one point where this goes back to the printmaking thing, is I enjoy making the print, but I don't enjoy doing big editions.
What does that mean?
So when you do and as I said, my experience is predominantly with lino cut. So once I finish the cutting of the block, I'm satisfied through doing a test print that I've got the image that I want. Then you set about doing an edition, which would be how many copies of that print that you're going to do. So some people often work on open editions, which just means that it's an endless run. You just print them, more of them as people want them. But most of the time, I would say most people run on a fixed edition, and there'll be, say, you know, 30 prints that you do. And you basically, what you're trying to do is get as consistent a print across those 30 as you possibly can.
Oh, yeah. If you can do exactly the same thing, or you think you are, and yet the next print comes out very different to the last one.
Yeah.
But I guess, Emmett, the perception is those limited runs make your prints more valuable. Well, not the perception, sorry, the idea.
Because damage, I guess, happens through printing just slightly, I guess. There's little alterations that happen, or?
Yeah, the shorter the run in principle, the more valuable, you know, it's just more limited. But then there are printmakers out there who are, you know, who are selling works, you know, that excellent quality work. And it's not unusual to see editions of 100 or 200 by successful printmakers, and they're marketing them across the country. You'll see them at things like the Society of Wood Engravers exhibitions. Immense talents, and they can get that consistency where you could put 10 prints beside each other and not be able to spot any difference. And that's what these are, people at the top of their game. I wasn't bothering those people.
that's not what gets you off.
No. And I wasn't able to. And it's something that takes time. But I was like, once I got that image, I'd like to do some to be able to, because obviously it's everyone wants to sell work. You know, some of my editions are only five. I don't think I've done anything over 20. And I just, it wasn't really hitting that box for me. And
It wasn't fun to do somehow. Like, it just wasn't your thing. Is that what you mean?
I think I get frustrated with the technical process, but also it's the time. It takes time. And I've never worked full time as an artist, never where I've had 7 days a week to focus on that. And I do think, the time that you have, you need to, and I'm still getting to grips with this, but it's the thing about, you've got to treat it like a job. You've got to turn up every day and do that, or the days that you decide that's what you're going to do. I honestly believe that is true, because I've complained about having a block. I've complained about this stopping me from working. The best stuff that I do is when I just get in the studio, or I just make sure that I sit there and I do something, and I stop listening to the voice that tells me it's rubbish, or that I'm not going to do this, and I just do it. And I get there and do it. And then day two, or, you know, the fourth hour that I'm doing it, something clicks and I stop worrying about that and I just get on with it. And you just treat it like another job. And we romanticize it sometimes, and it isn't always romantic.
But it's the perspiration over inspiration, as always. Just got to get in there and perspire.
Do you have any tips for anybody out there who, how do I put this? So I teach kids, right? I teach, during the pandemic, I was teaching kids on Zoom, and kids give themselves sometimes a lot of heartache when they can't draw something the first time the way they want to. And I would be like, don't tell yourself that. You got to be your best friend and all this, and giving them the lecture. And then the very next day, I was in a similar situation, and I was giving myself, going, why couldn't I, you know, why did I not be, why can't I pull that tree off, or whatever it was? And I realized that I did it. Now, and if you had asked me that the day before, I would have said, I'd never do that. I'm my best friend. So I think it surprised me that I was so hard on myself, right? Because I don't assume that of myself. So is there any way that people can see that in themselves, or ways that to shut it off? Do you have any tips on that?
You've got to accept that everyone has bad days. Social media is a brilliant thing, but it can be a destructive thing in terms of your own motivation. If you look at a wide enough source of stuff, you're going to see things where people are, you know, hugely complimentary in comments on Instagram, for instance, about a drawing or an image of something. And you'll look at it and think, that's shocking. And that's the moment you've got to remind yourself of, you know, this drawing might not be great for me at the moment, but I'll probably look at it tomorrow and find something else that I'll get from it. It's about giving yourself a break, really. And I always try and remind myself, it's better to do, the fact that I'm drawing is the key thing. It's not, you know, how it goes or whatever. And actually, again, the work thing, just doing more of it, because it becomes more instinctive. One of the best things that's happened to me in the last 2 years or so is trying to making a regular commitment to going to a life drawing class, because sometimes that's the only hours of drawing that I get in a week. But the more I draw, the more comfortable I am with it, the less I start overthinking every line that I put down, and it becomes more instinctive.
I think that's going to be my New Year's resolution, to do that.
Yeah, I'll come with you.
Really? Because I've been saying that for years, and they're so close. There's one just in East Oxford, a few of them, in fact. Okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of schools within, they're pretty close to you, which are, you know, life drawing's gone through a boom at the moment. And we're really lucky in Botley. Ali Hogg from Isis Framing has set up a group, and it's a cramped little room. And there's, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 people in there drawing, and it's an awkward space. It's not necessarily perfect for it, but it's intense. And for 2 hours, you sit there and you draw, and it's supportive.
Does that take the pressure off a bit, though, that it's not some kind of, you know, lofty art studio that you're just, you know, all normal people squished into a little space?
Yeah, I think so. It's not a taught session. You know, Ali books the model. There's a little bit of a discussion about what sort of poses or how long the poses are, and you just get on with it. And everyone's really supportive. And there's a huge range of styles in there with what people do. And some people are going, you know, yeah, I'm just going to do abstract, whatever takes me on this session. And, you know, there's usually about three or four different mediums in play. So but it's just very freeing. And it is that thing of, you know, it's putting in the hours, just keep doing it. Because anyone who says that every drawing they do is perfect, whatever, is not being honest with.
They're lying. Yeah, they're full of crap. That's what they are.
Give yourself a break with it. You know, it's I think that's the key.
Mike Killer on Instagram, you know, people showing off their sketchbooks. And like, I've got 100 sketchbooks and they're a mess, right? Someone's going to have a lot of fun. If ever I make it, someone's going to have a lot of fun in a few hundred years trying to figure them out. But, you know, yeah. And they're perfect. They're like pristine images on each page. It's like a work of art. And that to me, sure, that's, you know, it is a form of art, but that's not what a sketching's about and trying to lose yourself into something. It's completely a different thing.
This is pressure that we put on ourselves because, you know, sketchbook is a wonderful tool to have, but it doesn't work for everyone. I know artists who don't use sketchbooks. And art schools you talk to anyone who's been through art schools over the last 20 years, every art school has gone through a phase of where they've had a course where they've basically discouraged their students from using sketchbooks. They've encouraged them to jump straight into media. You talk about New Year's resolutions. That's my goal for the next year, is to work more in the landscape that I work from. Because I think I'll get something more from it, and it won't necessarily be direct. I think I'm going to worry less about a literal translation, which is always a huge hurdle for me.
We could set up a little plein air group, you know,
why not?
Go out once a month and just go do something with whatever you want to do it with.
And just like the life drawing, just kind of make it immersive and like your sort of bio that you supplied to us before the show, Emmett, you know, not trying to make a finished product, which I think is what I through school and whatever was always encouraged to do. You know, you've got to make a nice drawing. No, you don't have to do that. Why?
Well, I think as artists, we're really good at that. It's usually at the point when you least need it, you remember all these criteria of like that you should be having a full and active sketchbook that you contribute to every day. You should be doing this. You should be, you know, it's, you've got to give yourself a break. If you're not able to do it full time and you're not in a position to be able to do that, if you can get something valuable out of that time, whatever it is, even if it turns out to be a drawing that you don't want to show someone, if you enjoyed doing the drawing, that was valuable.
Yeah. I think that's what a sketchbook is for, really. It's not about planning even. It's just about doodling, you know, for me anyway. It's a place for me to just get inspired by something in reality and then apply it to something imaginary and then pull something together that works and everyone loves.
I did an exercise during lockdown of artist Laura Degenhart recommended the Artist's Way book to me because I was complaining. I was had a bit of a block, and which I'm gathering you're familiar with. And I did the exercise for probably a good year or so of the daily writing, and I do drop into that regularly. Well, I say regularly every now and again when I'm feeling like I'm really stuck.
And can you explain to us, Emmett, for people who aren't familiar with the Artist's Way, what that daily writing involves?
So it's a self-help book, basically, for creatives. If I remember rightly, the author whose name escapes me.
Julia Cameron. Yeah.
That's it. Yes. Mm-hmm. She's an author, I think, rather than an artist. But she talks about basically the process of just doing this daily commitment. And the first stage of it, the book goes through several stages, and it talks about giving yourself time to, for instance, like go to visit exhibitions or, you know, making commitments of chunks of time. And one of the first stage of it is to basically get up in the morning and you write you just open a book and you write, say, I think it's two sides of A4, and you just write. It's just like a stream of consciousness. Don't overthink what you're writing. You just write it and get to the end. You don't reread it or anything like that. And then the next day you just do it again, and you just do that.
It's all about like not judging yourself and just like observing yourself, but not judging as you do it, right? Mm.
Yeah, exactly. And in a way, what struck me was that's kind of what I was doing in that. It was like, well, that's kind of the freedom that I should allow myself with a sketchbook is to just do that, not worry about it. Almost like just turn the page over. Don't never look at it again, because just whatever you've done. And you know, we say things like, oh, well, that was just doodling or whatever. It's all valid. It's all mark making. It's all, you know, something that's coming out of your head.
And it's all a step on the process, on the path to whatever it is that you do want to create.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when I was writing for some of the papers on the masters, my brother was doing his PhD at the time, and I spoke to him about the process of writing. And he just said he did a similar thing of basically where he got up in the morning or when he was trying to write, he would just write for a period of time, just, you know, hammering away at his laptop, and then delete the pages and start over again. Because you can get over precious about these things. And sometimes it's, you know, it's like you if you went to the gym or something, you would warm up, you know?
Yeah, I have a thing that I always try and remind myself of, which is if you're doing something that's a bit challenging, the first half an hour of it is always horrible. Because I think your brain fights you as well. You know, if you're kind of, you know, comfortable, you know, you've been sitting down watching telly or eating your dinner or whatever, you're in kind of in your comfort zone. If you're then going to try and challenge yourself at, you know, at the gym, work, writing, art, whatever, your brain is always going to fight that. And you, like you say, yeah, you need to warm up. So I try and remind myself always that the first 30 minutes is generally always going to be painful.
Yeah, it's just stretching. Yeah. It's like you don't jump in and do 50 jumping jacks right away. Well, not at my age anyway.
can I just go back to the income question? In terms of trying to make some money through art, what's worked for you, Emmett? Because presumably you've tried a few different things so far. I mean, do you sell online? I mean, I know you do art weeks. Does that work well for you?
I sell work. I don't consistently sell work. So things like art weeks is a very good focus for me in a lot of ways. I don't sell enough from Art Weeks to say that it provides me with a significant chunk of my income.
Mm. Oh, again, for people who don't know, Art Weeks is a huge open studio festival that we have in Oxfordshire.
Yeah, in the spring. It's fantastic.
Been speaking to Esther Lafferty.
Yeah, she was on just the last show. Yeah, so people can go listen to that show if they want to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Art Week's Oxfordshire is, I think I'm right in saying it's the original open studio festival and the biggest in the country.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It's a big enterprise, and it's every May, and it's a great way to go and see what's going on art in your area. Great way to go and meet other artists. There's a lot of artists do the rounds and they speak to each other. I found it a really rewarding experience.
Financially for you, Emmett, has it been good?
Yes, I've always more than covered my costs. I think it's very important to keep a handle on what you're putting out on these things. And I think as artists, we can get a little wrapped up and go, right, well, I need frames. I've got to go and do this. And you've got to hit a balance because, you know, you can set yourself with a very high target to hit if you're not careful about what you're buying. So I learned very quickly to standardize my, if I was going to framework, standardize it and keep it minimal. Because
that's so funny. I learned that my first year. I made loads of paintings, right? And I cropped them to make them perfect, right? Because I wanted to capture. And then I was like, how do I frame all this? Right? Oh my God. It was a nightmare. Yeah.
It's a framing frenzy, isn't it? But yeah, like you say, if you can find a way to standardize and make your life easier on that front.
Yeah, do it.
I see you say that, but I think I see with what you're doing, you know, what you are doing is you're creating these prints and you're pairing them beautifully with frames that really suit the print. And, you know, you package and present your prints, Sally, really, really well. And I think that's a skill in itself.
Oh, thank you.
You're professional, Sally, realsies.
I realized a couple of things is I enjoy the process with Art Weeks. I do. I am lucky enough to have been able to sell work relatively consistently over the years that I've done it. And over the last couple of years, I've made more of an effort with things like cards. That's been a really good way to help cover the costs. I would say card sales alone covered my registration costs last year.
Wow.
So, which is good.
I think that's true for me as well, actually. Yeah, cards sell really well.
People want to support you.
Yeah.
They love the principle of it. They might not want to support you enough to buy a £50 or a £100 print or a painting or something like that. But people use cards. It's a great way to do it. So, yeah, if you do Art Weeks and you don't do that kind of thing, give it a shot. It doesn't have to be a huge investment, but... and worst case scenario, you've got plenty of cards to use for people's birthdays.
Even if they don't like your art, send them anyway.
They will like it eventually. You just got to wear them down. But yeah, so and I've been lucky enough to sell work through the odd exhibition or from I was lucky enough to sell work from my degree show. So. I would say it's not, I'm not approaching it from the same point of view, perhaps, as say that Sally is and that a number of people are out there. I am trying to hit a balance in terms of I'm doing a job that gives me a certain amount of freedom and flexibility. And the idea is that I can then go, well, I'll do this many days a week, or I'm going to do this for 2 weeks, and then I'm going to take a week off and spend that in the studio. And so I've recently made a move to being freelance so I can manage my time better. And as well as doing carpentry, I've now started to move a lot into the area of art handling and art technician work, which comes in blocks of work. For instance, I've just done 2 weeks working at Modern Art Oxford, installing an exhibition with a team there.
Great.
Cool. That's quite a fun job, I bet, for you.
It is, and it uses a lot of skills that I already have.
Yeah.
And I have to thank Brooks. There was a module on the master's called professional experience, and it's an aspect of the course where they ask you to consider how your practice can either work with the world or how you might be able to look at it from the point of view of earning money. Or whether it's something that you can maybe find a way to do courses or community work. It's a fixed part of the course, so you have to go through the process. And so I decided to look into doing art handling and technician work. And it really just, it gave me that focus. And it's been something since the course that I've been able to do consistently.
Yes, brilliant.
And so I've been expanding on that. So, and it's a traditional... I was talking to one of the technicians last week and he said, well, this is kind of most of the people in this job. This is what it is, what most of them are. And I was working with six other artists and they're all, you know, it's a flexible job where I can use my practical skills. And then I've still got time to be able to work on my process. So your practice doesn't have to be paying the bills all of the time. And I think when you've got people who aren't artists or extended family, they don't always get that. And there is no shame in saying, you know, people go, so what do you do to pay the bills? Go, well, I do this, but I do my art. And that doesn't lessen your art.
Exactly.
Because you have so much knowledge and experience, Emmett, can I ask you for a pithy piece of advice that you would have for, say, teenagers or university graduates who want to make a career out of art or want art to be a big part of their lives? Do you have to sacrifice some of your true artistic self and become commercial if you're going to be able to eat and pay the bills
or have a side hustle?
Yeah. What would you recommend?
I think you've got to be, I would say, be honest with yourself with what you want to get out of it. If you want to earn money and that's more important to you than what your practice is, or what you think about art, there's nothing wrong with that. Go and chase that money. That's fine. It gives you that quality of life. But if And like for me, it took me a good while to figure this out. Making my art is something that is very closely tied to my well-being. So I need to make time for that to happen. And if I can find a way in the long term to make money doing that as well, then that's great. But I've got to do this and I need to have a side hustle, and I'm cool with that. For that student, that teenager, it could be finding a role working within a local workshop where you can do that. And it means that you get some workshop time to pursue your own work. Or it could be volunteering with something that gives you then access to be able to train people or run courses. There are a number of different ways.
You could call up artists like me and Sally and say, hey, I'll help you organize stuff and I'll do it for free for a month. And then you tell everybody I'm brilliant.
Let's put our numbers up at the end of the show. We need help.
I would say it's like, be honest with yourself, but give yourself a break, and nothing happens overnight. I think one thing we can all agree on is it's a long push to be able to do this, but just be honest with yourself.
Yeah. And to find what works for you.
Yeah. And really cling to what the important part is, and, be kind to yourself.
Be kind to yourself. That's beautiful.
Amazing. Emmett, thank you for coming on Art Musings.
I've really enjoyed it.
Been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Can you remind us where people should go to learn more about your work?
Yes, my main sort of meanderings out there are on Instagram, which is Emmett_Casley. And you'll be able to see whatever I'm up to on there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
No, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. And good luck with the edit on that one.
Oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry. I'm a professional.
She is a profesh.
You've been listening to Art Musings with Love from Oxford with Sally Ann Stewart and Carole Terrio. If you like what you hear, subscribe to Art Musings wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Art Musings Oxford to see our brand new artworks and find out where we'll be next, so you can come and say hi in person.
We are wanting to reach out to as many artists and art lovers as possible, but we have a mountain to climb before any algorithms on the digisphere know we exist. So the thing is you can help us out, and it's easy peasy. Here's how. One, you can tell your arty friends about Art Musings. Two, subscribe to the show, and if you like what you hear, let us know. And you can do that by leaving any thought or questions or comment in the review section wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And three, we are hunting for Oxford artists to interview. If that's you, get in touch with us via Instagram, and that's at Art Musings Podcast.
And finally, cheers for being here. It means the world to us.
It does.